Hello and welcome to the inaugural podcast for the United States Secret Service, Standing Post, the inside stories of the Secret Service. I'm Cody Starkin, and I am proud and honored to be your host as we talk and discuss the past, present, and future stories of this great service. These stories will involve people from different backgrounds and experiences who make up the unique personnel here at the Secret Service. But we will also cover the various responsibilities beyond protecting presidents. These responsibilities will include programs and activities the organization participates in our day-to-day world. But before we start, I would like to spend a little time talking about me. I promise this will only be a few seconds. Like many of you, I was unaware of what the Secret Service exactly does beyond protecting the President of the United States. I've only been with the organization for a couple of months, so like you, I'm learning too. I want to bring you the best stories with each podcast, but we will take it slow for the first couple of months. We want to get this right, so the format may change due to listener listening rates, responses, and comments on the stories we provide. If we see a positive response, we may increase the story frequency or the direction of the podcast. However we proceed, we will always push forward together. The podcast will always be about the agents, uniform officers, and civilian workers who support the agency. Now, with that being said, my first guest is Deputy Assistant Director, Mr. Ronald Layton. He's a well-known and liked individual in the U.S. Secret Service. He is a native of Pittsburgh who has been on the Presidential Protection Detail, Counter-Assault Team, and now spends his time working for the Office of Protective Operations.
So welcome, Ron. How do you feel about being the first person on the inaugural podcast of Standing Post?
Boy, that sounds pretty lofty. I'll be honest with you, I am completely excited about doing this. I know that it's something that had been talked about for a while, and I'm glad that the agency has decided that this was a way that we could get our message out and be able to connect with people via technology. There are a lot of other organizations who have used the podcast to kind of talk to people and get their messages out. And I'm incredibly excited that that I get an opportunity to participate in this way. So I say all that to say I'm jacked, and it's awesome to be able to do this.
Well, I think one of the things that's going to be interesting to our listeners and why we chose you to do the inaugural podcast is maybe you can tell us a little bit about your past. Where do you call home? What did you used to do? And how you arrived here at the U.S. Secret Service?
Sure. I am a Pittsburgh kid. So I'm born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And interestingly enough, as I look at it, after being in the Secret Service for more than 25 years, Pittsburgh is a very interesting blue-collar town. And what I've come to find out is that the Secret Service, while we may wear white shirts, this is really a blue-collar job. And we work very hard. We work long hours. We do it all over the globe. But I think coming from a city that really prides itself on getting up and going to work every day in a hard blue-collar environment has really served me well coming here.
You, as one of your first jobs, was it a blue-collar job?
No, not really. So when I got out of college, I was fortunate enough to get to be a scholarship athlete and played football in Montana. And when I graduated with a degree in engineering. And, you know, for me, it was unusual to think of a technology-oriented person, which is what I am, like how does that fit into law enforcement? And so when I graduated from school, I got a job working as an electrical engineer. And my days were spent writing computer code. So I wrote a computer code for something called ICS, Industrial Control Systems, or SCADA networks. And that's what I did for a couple of years. And also in that time, I was fortunate enough to teach physics and mathematics at a university in Pittsburgh. And so transitioning into the Secret Service, coming from a technical background, was a little unusual because I wasn't really sure that a technology-oriented person would fit in a law enforcement organization. And I ended up having lunch with a Secret Service agent who, in essence, convinced me that his point was, take a look at all of the technology that you think might be involved in moving the president from point A to point B. And once I started to consider those things, I thought, yeah, there might be a place for me here. And I think at this point, what's interesting is that I came into the job as a special agent, but I could have very well came into the job in one of our engineering positions, which we have quite a few. But I guess more than anything else, the point is that I was able to take a technology background and use it here in service to the Secret Service.
The listeners wouldn't be able to see this, but as you walk in, you have a pretty noticeable ring on. Would you like to talk a little bit more about it, maybe go into your college days and playing football?
Sure. I was a scholarship athlete. I played at played football in Montana, in Butte, in Montana Tech. And what I wanted to do when I got out of high school was I wanted to mix two things that are pretty much oil and water, which is athletics and an engineering degree. Most universities, they may have offered the two, but it was just, it's hard to put them together because football in college takes, I mean, people don't realize you're between practice and getting ready for practice and films and games. That's usually about 7 hours a day, you know, of time spent either on the field or in the tank or the tub after practice, trying to get your body healed, those kinds of things. And I was able to combine that with really what is a world-class education coming out of Montana Tech. And I can remember, and I played 4 years of high school, 4 years of college. I can remember many moments on the football field that have served me reasonably well here. I think we were playing University of British Columbia, big school, 20, 30,000 people. And I think they won the national championship that year. And I can remember getting a separated shoulder in the second quarter and being silly enough or stubborn enough to finish the rest of the game. And that's one of those things where, you know, once you do that, if you've ever done it, it's quite painful. And most folks have sense enough to go, hey, I'm going to sit out or get some treatment or whatever. And I did that. I just waited till the game was over. And I say that to say what I've learned here is that law enforcement organizations have a tendency to oftentimes be judged when things don't go well, because the American public expects that we will respond to situations in a certain way. And I say all that to say, you know, getting back to the football experience is simply sometimes you have to play hurt. And that's a mentality. And that is a characteristic that many of us have on this job. We are people who are dogged, who are determined and incredibly mission focused. So I think I probably picked that up in a martial arts dojo or a football field or someplace like that, but it served me well here.
Well, you mentioned that you just mentioned martial arts. What do you specialize in, or do you have kind of a mixed martial arts background?
So I've been doing martial arts quite a while. So when I was growing up, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday was karate nights, usually from 7 to 9:30, 10 o'clock. Tuesday and Wednesday was jiu-jitsu, usually from 6 to about 8:30. And that was my life forever. And I have many, many applications of that kind of activity that have served me well here. I mean, aside from just the practical side, hey, we are an elite law enforcement organization. And being able to defend yourself is certainly something that we teach people. But if you come here with that skill set already intact, it's also a good thing. But at this stage of the game, I hold an 8th degree black belt in karate and an 8th degree black belt in jiu-jitsu. And I, during my competition days, I have 8 AAU gold medals in a number of, you know, tournament engagements where I was reasonably successful. But for me growing up, that's how I grew up. I started when I was 8 years old. So that gave me confidence, rigor, structure, discipline, all of those things that, as you can imagine, might serve you well in a law enforcement job. And they have, but that's my very early upbringing, and I've trained continuously at this point for many decades.
Have you found yourself using your martial arts in some of your instruction during your earlier days with the U.S. Secret Service?
Yeah, one of the things that I didn't talk about in my early jobs, I was also a police academy instructor. So I was an instructor in defensive measures from quite a while ago. And while I have never had an assignment at the training academy here, I have had many occasions where I've instructed others in some form, combatives or defensive measures. Lots of time doing that kind of stuff.
Your story up to this point, you went to Pittsburgh, or you grew up in Pittsburgh. You went to the Montana Tech and got your degrees.
So I don't. Some people think this is interesting. I don't. I quite frankly have always thought it was a pain in the ass. But I have two PhDs. And what I've tried to do is I've tried to, you know, take elements of what I've learned either in a business application or what I've learned through technological advancement, and I've tried to apply that here.
We have you growing up in Pittsburgh. We then you have you going to the university, or Montana Tech. We now have you at this point. When did you decide to join the U.S. Secret Service?
There are people who, and there are a lot of people like this on this job. We have, law enforcement is interesting because there's a lot of what I refer to as legacies here. There are a lot of people that are in my peer group who their fathers were Secret Service agents, some at executive levels. And for those peers, I mean, I can't imagine the dinner time conversations when these folks were 10, 15, 20 years old, because you would get to hear about all of the things that their dads had gone through, whether it was world travel or this happened with the president or we got on Air Force One or we were working this case and this crazy thing happened. I mean, I can't imagine hearing that as a youth. And I, you know, you'd get that right away because you'd say, wow, this is pretty exciting. I think I want to do that. Well, that was not the case at all for me. I didn't really think about this organization. I'd always had some general interest in law enforcement. Again, I had done other things in the private sector before I came here, and I just happened to meet a Secret Service agent. And he talked to me about, did you ever think about the Secret Service? And at that point, I had not. And once I started to think about how, you know, an engineer could fit into this organization, I became more interested. And I know we're going to talk about it in the course of the podcast, but you know, the lives of Secret Service personnel are really interesting with the things that folks here get a chance to see and do and participate in. So once I saw the window of opportunity that was open, I decided that I would step through it.
Do you mind telling us a little bit, in your own words, the history and overview of the United States Secret Service?
The Secret Service was formed in 1865, primarily to suppress counterfeit currency. At the time in the United States, more than 50% of the currency was counterfeit. It was no good. And, you know, because generally law enforcement does a great job at so many things, there's a tendency to take things for granted. So let's take you to a time where half of the money in your pocket wouldn't be any good and you wouldn't know it. I mean, can you imagine that? You wouldn't have the confidence of being able to walk around and purchase things without thinking, I wonder if the money that I'm handing to some merchant or paying a bill or whatever you were doing with your money was any good. So this had an incredible destabilizing effect with just the general confidence in not just the merchants, but the consumers, everybody. So we were originated in 1865 by the Congress. And then fast forward to 1901, with the assassination of President McKinley, that's when we picked up protective operations. And that's really the start of our integrated mission of performing investigations. And the early investigations were counterfeit investigations into protecting presidents.
Ron, do you have a favorite case that you worked on during your time with the U.S. Secret Service?
Sure. The way that this works in terms of progression for special agents is that you spend your first time period in one of our field offices, somewhere generally within the United States. And you do that for anywhere from 5 to 8, maybe 9 years. And then you come to your protective tour. But inside of that first series of activities that you go through as an agent, that's spent in our criminal enforcement squads. So our roots are in economic crime, starting with our counterfeiting mission. And so I can remember in Philadelphia, in my first office, working one of the criminal squads that was a really a bank fraud squad, and I wasn't the lead agent on the case, but I was participating in a search warrant, and we had enough evidence to obtain, which is for something that's called a search warrant. And to get a search warrant, that really means that you've got to collect enough probable cause, put it down on an affidavit on a piece of paper, and go in front of a U.S. attorney who will look at the document, make sure that it's in its proper form, and then ultimately take it to a federal judge and get it signed. And that's a very powerful instrument. It allows you to go search for evidence in a crime, oftentimes within someone's residence or car, something like that. So we go out to execute this search warrant. And what you're doing is just what it says the warrant permits you to do. You're looking for evidence of a certain crime. And I can remember, you know, the probably 8 or 9 agents conducting the search. And I can remember finding a piece of paper that looked like it had some type of circuitry on it that was a schematic of something, which I thought was odd, given that we were looking for evidence of financial crimes. And we're getting to the point where we are cataloging these things. And what happens is you catalog them oftentimes on site, and then you transport them back to your office where they are inventoried into evidence. Well, there was a safe in this room, and we figured, well, okay, we're doing a search warrant. We'll probably need to get into the safe. But it turned out that the smart thing to do was to get an additional search warrant for the contents of the safe. And so that meant that we were not going to leave it there. We were going to take it. And safe was fairly large. And my partner, who I still have a great relationship with and is one of my best friends, who's also, his name's Ron, the more senior agents in the room said, hey, the Ron, grab that safe and get it out of here. Well, the safe was 500 pounds. So we decided that we were going to, and it was, of course, it can't be, you know, on a flat surface. It has to be on the second floor, of course. Why wouldn't it be? So we take this safe and we walk this safe out. We're walking a 500-pound safe down the steps. And it's 2 steps, and then we set it down. But because it's 500 pounds, it's a little bit of a boom. So 2 steps, boom. 2 steps, boom. 2 steps, boom. And I can remember thinking to myself, boy, I would love to just roll this thing out of here. But, of course, we couldn't do that. We get the safe onto our truck, and we take it back to where? We take it back to the federal building. So remember about a minute ago I said there was this piece of paper that had a little bit of circuitry on it, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So someone, not myself and not the other Ron, as he was referred to, someone said, hey, why don't we just go ask a canine to go and sniff this safe? Now, the significance of the canine is that the canine is a explosives detection canine, right? So one of the things that happens is, and I had seen this by this time quite a few times in training scenarios. Now, this, of course, wasn't training, but I know that the reaction from a canine typically is that when he or she smells a residue of an explosive nature, they're trained to sit. And me being a dog lover, I love to watch the dogs work. And the dog, you know, oftentimes will sit and look up at the handler, tilt its head to the side, and give you like this Scooby look, like that kind of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. So, all right. So we call a police department. They come over and they come in. Where's that? And in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't think so. Anyway, the dog circles around the safe. And what's a dog do? Sit right down, look at the handle, and go, mm. So what has happened here? We just brought a bomb into our space. And, you know, in hindsight, I guess the moral of this story is, number one, don't be silly enough to roll a bomb down the steps.
Right.
But number two is, when you're working investigations, criminal actors, whatever you want to call them, bad guys, are oftentimes equal opportunity offenders. It's not like they just do one violation. So we were looking for evidence of bank fraud and other kind of fraudulent instruments, those kinds of things. And then what do we find? We find firearms. Ultimately, we find a bomb. So we find explosives. And of course, we find what we're looking for. But it's a good example. Number one, be careful with safes. And number two, it's a good example of how one investigation that you think is going to go in a linear fashion oftentimes doesn't. It tentacles in all of these other things. And if you were an investigator, really, you know, there's nothing better than putting that puzzle together and seeing how this thing unfolds. But it's just, you know, it was a good case. It was a fun case, and we were able to throw on a good number of additional charges, and we made sure that this particular defendant had the maximum criminal exposure.
Now, Ron, you were assigned to Strategic Intelligence and Information and are newly assigned to Protective Operations. How has your transition been?
It's been pretty interesting. I have had a number of supervisory assignments all throughout the agency. And coming from SII, that's really the intelligence arm of the Secret Service. So we would do things, people who walked up to the White House who said, I have an appointment with the president. And of course they didn't, but they had some engagement with the mental health community. All of those things to include things like threats via social media that could, of course, emanate from anywhere in the world. That's the world that I came from over in SII. And the thing about that job is that we were to deliver information to the customers. Who are the customers? The customers are people who stand next typically to the president, or they stand post protecting a Secret Service protected facility like the White House or the Vice President's residence or something like that. Those were the customers. So it was our job to take that information and give that to them so they could make the best use of that from an operational standpoint. If we had something called a national lookout, somebody who we know was going to do us harm, we would get that information to our customers just as expeditiously as I could. It's like saying, hey, somebody's coming, that kind of a thing. Well, now I'm on the other side of that. You know, I am the person who is the customer who is now receiving that information. So to be honest, the transition has been awesome because I have a better understanding of what goes into that product that ultimately I get to make sure that the folks who I work with are operationally ready to be able to face those threats. So it's been great. It's been awesome.
So after your transition into protection, is there any stories you'd like to share with the listeners during your time?
Sure. So let me give you a general idea of what we do in protective operations. I kind of look at it like this. Typically, we do two things and two things only. We build and maintain a secure environment for our protectees. Sometimes it's referred to as a protective bubble. Sometimes referred to as just a general protected space. Now that space could be the White House. It could be some place where the president is going during his transit from point A to point B. But what we do as an organization is we move that space, that protected area, from place to place. And if you look at it like this, you know, build a protective bubble and then maintain it, and then move that bubble all over the world, wherever wherever the president is. That's in essence what we do. And then, you know, this was a transition question. Some of the things that help us build that bubble are information, and that information comes from Strategic Intelligence and Information. But that contributes to the building of that protected space that we move around on a 24-hour basis.
Have you used any information from the Strategic Intelligence and Information Group to help better the protective mission yourself personally?
Sure. So we use it on a daily basis. We get on the SII side, it's a 24-hour operation because the threat stream is generally 24 hours, and so that is always contributing to how we make our spaces more safe. So that's an ongoing process that continues to expand and contract depending on the nature of the threat. But it's our job to take that information and use it in a way that's appropriate to make sure that the protectees are safe.
How long have you been in the U.S. Secret Service?
This is year 26 for me. And in 26 years, I've had this current assignment is my 10th supervisory assignment.
So with all that time in, you've probably seen a lot of leadership, a lot of mentors out there, but you specifically, what does leadership mean to you?
So for me, I think leadership is one of those things that there's no singular definition of what it is or what it means. But for me, especially from an organizational standpoint, is that you generally have a balance of something called transformative leadership and transactional leadership. And a lot of times in many institutions, that's the way that it's taught. James McGregor Burns probably wrote voluminously about what leadership is, and that's the way that he categorizes it. And certainly that's the way that it's taught in many elite institutions. But in a nutshell, transformative leadership just means that there is something about the organization that needs to be improved. So it needs to be transformed in some way from A to B. And the progress of A to B is making it better. But every organization has things that it does well. And those are the things that you probably need to leave alone. And that's transactional leadership. But the secret sauce to this is to figure out what's the balance of the two, especially in a large organization where you're trying to make, you're trying to gain efficiencies and you're trying to be better stewards of the public dollar. You're trying to be use and leverage technology to make you better. You know, that's the transformative piece of this. And it's interesting to see how we as leaders, you know, make assessments to try to figure out, you know, what's the best application of our resources in terms of just making the operation go smoother. So again, transformative versus transactional. And the reason that leadership is so important to the Secret Service is that during the course of a 20 or 25 or 30 year career, most every Secret Service employee will be thrust into a position of leadership, whether you are working to head an internal group here in headquarters, or maybe out in the field office, or maybe at the White House or another one of our protected sites. There are many, many opportunities to lead internally. But if you think about the nature of what we do, particularly when a protectee moves around the country or moves around the world, we don't do it by ourselves. We never could. So we depend on our partners. Sometimes those partners are federal partners, sometimes they're state and local partners, and many times they're international partners when we travel abroad. But those folks who assist us, they are looking for direction and leadership from us. So I say all that to say there will be multiple occasions for anyone on this job who stays to lead. And, you know, in order to do that, you need a few things. You need training. You need education, and you need opportunities to lead in positions that give you escalating responsibilities as you go on throughout your career. And, you know, the Secret Service is an elite organization, and dare I say, the world's finest when it comes to protective operations. And so people look to us as a model of how to do this. And leadership is a strong, strong component of how we go about our business.
For our listeners that don't know, our organization's broken up today in about three different distinct organizations or personnel sections. You have the agent, the uniformed officer, and then the administrative, professional, and technical personnel that we have on staff to support. Can you go in a little bit more about that?
Sure. Like any other organization, we have, generally speaking, we have about six classifications of personnel. As you said, administrative, professional, technical. We have special officers. We have uniformed division police officers. And we have special agents. Right now, we are right about 7,000 personnel with a $2 billion budget. We are aggressively moving forward towards something that we refer to as 95-25 in 2025. And it's just what it says. It's 9,525 strong in 2025. And we're going to get there with the help of the department and funding from the Congress. And we are very excited about where we're going. I think the thing that's important to realize is that there is no one job classification any more important than the other. I think I said earlier, I came into this job as a special agent, but I could have come in as an engineer or some other function in the technical track just because that was my background. But I promise you, this is a highly team-oriented organization. We move forward based on the collective efforts all of our teammates. I mean, when we need to move personnel around the world, someone had to make logistics arrangements. Somebody had to meet you on the ground. So we work in a high team-oriented environment, and it's a collective effort to ensure that our mission gets executed. And for the proud men and women who patriotically stand next to the president or who make sure that the lights get turned off at the end of the day. So think about how or what would have to happen to just move personnel around the world. Someone would have to process your voucher. You would have to get a rental car. All those logistics are made somewhere. Somebody has to do that. Someone would have to pick you up. Someone would have to get you a hotel reservation. Someone has to write a report. Somebody has to pay you. We all would like to be paid every 2 weeks. I mean, the point is that in an organization where you've got a high team orientation for a mission, which we refer to as a zero fail mission, you've got a lot of people that are involved in that make that happen. Some are, let's just say, behind the scenes, and some are on stage. But the point is, those people would never, ever get on stage if it wasn't for the people that were behind them supporting them. So it's a total collective effort.
For those listening, can you provide some facts about the Secret Service that they may not know about? For a lot of us, especially me before joining, all we knew were what we saw on TV, television, men and women in suits with black glasses on and mics in their sleeves.
So I think that was my experience too. I mean, you would look at, you know, a president on television and you would see these guys in the back and like, well, how come some guys have sunglasses and what's in their wrist that they're talking to? I mean, that's what everybody says. That's the iconic kind of visual that you think of when you think about the organization. But I think to the general public, most people wouldn't know about our investigative mission and how the investigative mission is integrated with our protective mission. So in the United States, there are 320 million people, and we have the largest economy in the world. The Secret Service, I mean, we are the protectors of the financial infrastructure. I mean, we are the ones who work against economic criminals to make sure, in part, that that economy runs smoothly. I don't think most people would know that. And what's interesting is that the Secret Service has been able to be among the best computer crimes investigators in the world today. So I think as we're known for the people who stand next to the president, people typically wouldn't know how prolific and how great we are at electronic crimes. We've got about a 25-year career or a 25-year history going from crimes that were typically the old paper crimes, paper to plastic to digital, where now we are among the elite class of investigators worldwide in the electronic crimes investigations. People probably wouldn't know that. And another just, you know, interesting fact is that in 1908, the Department of Justice hired, today we would say detailed, 9 Secret Service agents to do nationwide investigations for the Justice Department. Well, that organization today is called the FBI. And then every once in a while, on occasion, we remind our FBI counterparts.
What message do you have for people who may want to join the U.S. Secret Service?
So I think if you are interested in this organization, you need to know that this is a very exciting but unusual lifestyle. We have some things that we consider to be our non-negotiables. And the non-negotiables are simply our core values, not what we do, but who we are. Justice, duty, honor, loyalty, courage. That's what makes us the elite organization that we are. And so if you are interested in service to your country in an unusual way to help us further our mission of investigations, of protection, if you are interested in that, we're certainly interested in you. And I couldn't think of a better way to serve our great nation.
Do you care to add anything else before we wrap up?
So I do, and it dovetails back into why. So some of the why is, you know, we have a complete diversity of assignment here, which most folks wouldn't know. You could be early in the morning running down a criminal enforcement matter. Maybe you're looking for one of our fugitives. Maybe you're involved in a surveillance. And in 24 hours later that same day, you could be standing next to the President of the United States and everything in between. Does that happen all the time? No, it doesn't happen all the time, but it happens enough to give you an idea of how diverse this is as a career choice.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Ron. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for being able to be a part of the inaugural podcast for Standing Post. Really appreciate it.
And I appreciate it. It was great to be here, and great to try to get our message out to all the listeners. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the inaugural podcast of Standing Post. We look forward to providing you great content in the future, so we hope you subscribe and you continue the journey with me. In the future, the podcast will continue to invite personnel throughout the Secret Service to talk and discuss topics regarding our great organization. Again, I want to thank you, the listener, and also Ronald Layton for being our first guest on the inaugural podcast. Until the next one, stay vigilant.